Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, breaking news out of Rome, arrivederci bunga bunga. Prime Minister Berlusconi is out. Greece's Prime Minister Papandreou is also taken out by the EU fiscal crisis. The French Prime Minister has some stern words for President Obama at the G20 conference. Should the Greek and Italian resignations be a wake-up call for the White House? Speaking of the White House, who's running the show over there? Bill Daley has turned over day-to-day operations to his deputy. Is the White House staff at war? Question for people in Washington, who didn't Herman Cain allegedly harass? Continued fallout for the GOP frontrunner. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Capital. It is time for Blog Talk Radio's premier roundtable political discussion. This is Backroom Politics live from Philly's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District, former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Welcome back, Congressman.
Hello this afternoon.
Hello. And to my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome.
Always glad to be here.
And to my right, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He has served in many positions under four presidents. He has also served as a Senate staffer, longtime Senate staffer, here in Washington, D.C. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
We got a lot going on, but first we want to touch big breaking news out of Rome. Prime Minister Bunga Bunga, that's an inside joke for those of you guys, he Bunga Bunga rooms, we'll get to that in a little bit. But Prime Minister Berlusconi is out in Rome. According to press reports, he has agreed to step down as Prime Minister of Italy and President of the Italian government. As a result of the fiscal crisis passing, or the bill in the Italian legislature passing, as soon as it passes, he has decided to step down. This is big news. I mean, Berlusconi, many thought, was untouchable. He's had a lot of Teflon on a lot of issues, but it's the fiscal crisis that brought him down. Bob, does this surprise you a little bit?
Well, he's had 9 lives, and he's used them all up, I think. It's a little bit surprising. I thought that he'd probably try to stay on a little bit longer and see the see all the legislative activity they're trying to get past, some of the austerity programs and the other things they're doing in their legislature. I think he has decided, and it seems to me that I can't think of the guy's name, the Northern Alliance, which is part of his group, coalition government, and they're out of Milan, I believe, and
right.
That's the major city, the major political operation in northern Italy, and they have been supporting him for a long time. And I saw something in the paper just a day or so ago. I think the guy's name is Bossi or something like that.
Right.
And he was saying that he thought that it maybe was time for Berlusconi to leave because of the problems he was having leading the country with all the baggage he has. And that may have been a signal to Berlusconi that he ought to jump before he's pushed.
Al, I mean, this is going to have political ramifications throughout the entire Italian government. But to have the head of state in Italy be taken down by the fiscal crisis, is that a sign that the EU's really got a much larger problem than maybe many in the global community have been led to believe?
It may be, but the thing that kind of fascinates me is after all that Berlusconi has gotten away with for all these years, he gets taken down by this. It's a little like Al Capone being taken down for
by
income tax evasion. I think that you can only stack your misdeeds so high before they topple, and it, who knows which straw it is that makes it go over, but clearly this one was the financial situation.
But, Alan, I mean, Berlusconi can't be held accountable just for the fiscal crisis. I mean, he's had other political issues that he's managed to just brush off. The economic issue is something that the entire Italian government's got to hold responsibility for. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. I mean, it's but it's if you're the head guy when things go south, you take the major blame. I think that it, we all know about some of his peccadillos, if you will. The Italian electorate has a little different view of such things than the American electorate. But what they don't want, what the Greeks don't want, what the Portuguese don't want, what the Spaniards don't want, is a major set of sacrifices that's coming in the face of the fiscal crises that those countries face. And that's ultimately what did him in. I think that in this case, what did him in was the thing that needed to do him in, which was being the head guy at a time when the bill came in and he's having to pay. He lost a vote in the parliament and has said he will step down as soon as budget reforms are completed. It's amazing he survived this long given all the other stuff.
Well, you know, when we look, I mean, let's be honest, when your closest ally tells you, and Bob, you had mentioned this earlier, Umberto Bossi, who's one of Berlusconi's closest advisors, when he says this ship is sinking, you know, what's the next step here? I mean, there's the majority party in Italy now has got a credibility problem just because of the fact that Berlusconi survived as long as he did. But can they regain credibility in the EU regarding the fiscal crisis as a result of Berlusconi stepping down?
I don't know so much. It's a question of whether, you know, getting respect back or something. It's, you know, Italy, no matter who is the government, which party is, parties are part of the coalition that runs the country, they're in big trouble. Their debt ratio to their gross domestic product is worse than ours. It's worse than almost anybody's. It's almost as bad as the Greeks, and they are a major. I think they're the fourth largest economy in Europe behind the Germans and the French. No, I think they're the third behind the Germans
and
the French.
Between the German and the French, correct. Yeah.
So, I mean, they're a huge economy. Now, if they go south, I mean, you know, Greece is just a little piker compared to how big the economy and how big the fall would be and the tremors that would go out if Italy fails. And they are in deep trouble. And they're having a hell of a time getting anything past the legislature.
But Alan, you know, when we've seen the Italian government pass two austerity measures previously. The EU deemed them insufficient, which probably helped push Berlusconi maybe over the top. But there's a problem right now inside the Italian government, particularly inside the Italian legislature, that says, I mean, they've got a deadlock now. Berlusconi's majority and the new People's Party has absolutely no ability to get anything through. Is this the type of shakeup that Italy needed to maybe get their ducks in line?
Well, what they had before didn't work, so we can hope so. These are very, very difficult decisions that have to be made in countries where the people expect, as we in America seem to now also, think that you can get a dollar's worth of stuff for 60, 70 cents. And you can't indefinitely. And where all countries are facing up to this, it's now Italy's turn. The worst offenders are having to be at the front of the line.
Congressman Al, do you think that Berlusconi just failed to provide any sort of leadership as far as giving direction to getting Italy out of its current problem?
I think the entire Western democracies have failed to understand the long-term problem. Now, the Republicans will tell you, we've been warning you for years. That may be the problem. They've been saying the same thing over and over and over again, and everybody stopped listening to them. But the fact is, you can't continue to provide social programs and other expensive programs that run more than your revenue and expect it to last. And every one of those countries has done that. And we are doing. And the fact is, as I've said before in this program, a democracy is easy as long as you're giving stuff away. It gets a lot harder when you start taking things back.
And they've tried to pull stuff back. I mean, Berlusconi, these two austerity measures that he pushed through, even though the EU didn't deem them sufficient, in the eyes of the Italian people seem to believe him. Where did he lose his credibility? Was it he was too focused on himself? Was it the past scandals that just everybody threw up their hands and said, "Look, now's the time. You're done." But
I don't know. But I do know one thing. I saw a report today that Italy is trying to issue some bonds, and they're being asked to pay over 6% interest. You cannot support that kind of a thing long term. 6% plus interest is too much of a load to carry. I mean, I think the United States is probably about half of that right now.
Well, right now the Italian gross amount, right now the debt is at 120% of GDP in Italy, and that's second only to Greece. The news has always been focused on Greece, Portugal, Ireland,
Spain,
Portugal. This is the first time that a major economic player has had problems. Is this maybe signs of things to come? Could France or Germany be next on the pike?
No, and this is not news with Italy. I mean, Italy was always one of those that was up there. France and Germany are the two countries, and some of the smaller, the Belgians and the Netherlands, that are propping things up. And, of course, the public in those countries is saying, wait a minute, why are we having to prop up the bad behavior of some of our, if you will, southern brethren, the northern versus southern Europe divide? But this isn't about Berlusconi. This is, I mean, he's certainly an interesting aspect and a player. This is about, as we've said, a long period of time of taking more out than you pay into the system, and it catching up. And it caught up to all of us rather abruptly in the last few years when the world economy turned out to be a lot more fragile and a lot more interconnected than we thought or than we wanted to be. Hard, hard decisions have to be made, and it's not as though Berlusconi could have fixed everything. He couldn't. He didn't have the credibility that he might have had for other reasons, but good luck in Italy coming up with a leader who can pull a coalition together to make hard choices.
Bob.
One of the things that is most concerning about the Italian situation is that their bonds have been heavily, I mean, the French and the German and the Dutch banks have all bought millions and billions of dollars of their bonds. If they're required to take a haircut, quote-unquote, the way the Greek bondholders have, 50%, that's going to cause a ripple effect across Europe, the likes of which we haven't seen.
Well, I mean, Alan, as a former Undersecretary of Commerce dealing with international trade, does this give American industrial leadership a little bit of pause, seeing what's happening in Italy? Does this just prove that the instability in the fiscal situation in the EU is a lot broader than we might have thought?
No, I don't think there's that big a surprise here. I think it just reaffirms, it confirms what we're worrying about in Western wealthy democracies. It's not that big a surprise. It was scary yesterday, it's scary today, and it'll be scary tomorrow.
Is this going to create a trade issue between the U.S. and Italy? Are we going to be less likely to do trade with Italy now that there's some turmoil in government?
I don't know about less likely. Trade is driven by different things. If somebody doesn't pay you, that's one thing. Now, they're part of the euro, and this is one of the challenges for the Germans and the French. It's not as though the Italian currency can crater and help bail the country out. They're all linked in together with the euro, and you got to know that the UK is saying, boy, am I glad that we didn't join that euro union.
We're coming up on our first break. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion. We're going to talk about Greece and the fallout for Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, he's out. We're going to talk about the ramifications of that. That's got a lot more sensitivity to it near term than the Italian. I think the Italian's going to be a lot more long term as we look forward to the fiscal crisis. We invite everybody who's listening, you can call in, ask questions. Our call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 Ash Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. You can call in and join the conversation at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477 to join the discussion here as we talk about the continuing EU fiscal crisis facing the global economy. We just talked about the breaking news out of Rome where Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has agreed to step down as the head of state in Italy as a result of the fiscal crisis. As soon as that bill passes, his resignation will be in front of the legislature. Now, we've also seen another head of state in Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou. He has now stepped down, and an interim government led by the Greek president, Carlos Papalias. He hosted closed-door meetings to agree to come up with a unity government to address the fiscal crisis right now. But the question still remains is Papandreou's departure with Papalias coming in, is this a little too late, Alan?
Well, I don't know about too late. They just like Italy, they've got some very hard decisions to make. the problem for Papandreou was that he cut a deal with the Europeans, which was a very difficult, painful deal for the northern European countries. They were going to have to kick in a lot of dough, and their banks and financial institutions were going to have to take this haircut that Bob referred to the tune of 50%. And in return for that, the Greeks were going to have to do some things. And then all of a sudden, after all of that pain from all around, Papandreou said, let's put it to the people. Suddenly, it completely shook up the markets. Hundreds of billions of dollars were lost in stock markets all over the West. And Papandreou looked like, frankly, pardon the expression, an idiot.
Right.
So it was not a surprise. I mean, I don't know if he could have survived at the get-go, because he had a very, very narrow majority. But after that, after becoming sort of ridiculed and a laughingstock and an embarrassment to the rest of Europe, it was just a matter of time. Now he's gone. It's not like it's an easy path for whoever follows him.
I mean, Papandreou was an interesting figure in Greek politics anyways. He was an American born in Minnesota. His grandfather was the former prime minister. His father was very active in Greek politics, both here from the United States and domestically back in Greece. When he took office in 2009, many saw him as kind of being, you know, the new wave of new leadership to come in and bring Greece to prominence again. But Bob, an $11 billion bailout agreement, that's painful. Is there some sort of responsibility that maybe the EU should have seen this coming, perhaps, Bob?
Well, look, everybody could see this coming. I mean, I think Al said it very well early on in our conversation. Most of the Western nations have been underfunding the programs that they have created for their retirees. You can retire on, you know, two-thirds of salary at 50 in Greece, I think. I mean, you know, that kind of thing is just unsustainable. And that's true in I think, most of the Western societies as we speak, including the United States. And the fact of the matter is, when you reach a situation like that, everybody wants somebody else to pay for it. And so you don't have a constituency saying, oh, yes, please cut me. And every government, in one way or another, is going to be facing this problem. We're certainly facing it. Just to get away for a minute, look at our super committee. They're not getting very far, apparently, on making a deal. They've got 10 days to go. We'll talk about it later.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, there's a real problem right here at home. It may not be as bad as the Greeks or the Italian folks, but it isn't an easy one, because nobody wants to take a reduction in benefits or pay more for the current benefits.
Now, you know, when the EU deal was struck with Papandreou, he then backed off and said, you know what, I need to put this to people. He rescinded that. As a former member of Congress, was that the right move? Should he have put it up for a referendum, or should that have been inside baseball?
If he wanted to defeat it, he should have put it up for a referendum. That's just one of those calls that leadership is supposed to make if they're constitutionally capable of doing it. And putting it up was the term idiotic was used. I think that's correct. It also seems to me that when we're talking about should somebody have seen this yesterday or last month or last year or somewhere in the 90s, we're not looking far enough back. This all, you know, started to get out of hand long before it became apparent where it could lead. And so there is, if there's anything to blame, it is the fact that democracy, and I've already said it, democracy can't take things away. It needs to be a hell of a lot more careful, therefore, what it's giving away.
But Alan, you're familiar with the Eurozone and the Euro itself. Was the Eurozone a flawed concept from the beginning, now that we're seeing the fallout that we are?
beats the heck out of me, but it certainly looks like it.
Yeah.
Now with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, it always was going to be a challenge to get countries with such different cultures and economies and natural resources and human resources to come together with a common currency without a common centralized banking system, without a unified parliament. It always had a lot of risk, and that was one of the main reasons that the UK and others decided to watch from the sidelines.
Well, one of the concerns that a lot of who are watching what's happening in Greece and in Italy are concerned about is the fact that they're going to go to the absolutely opposite end of the spectrum. They're going to replace Papandreou and Berlusconi with some technocrats. One of the names that we've heard in Greece is one of Greece's premier economists, a gentleman by the name of Lucas Papaneros. Everybody's laughing. It's like reading off a Greek menu today. But Papaneros is one of the people that they're talking as being a candidate for the new prime minister. Are they going overboard by putting in some technocrats, you think, Bob?
I know about as much about Greek politics as I do about the dark side of the moon. I mean, to me, it seems to me that it is more important that whoever is put in, technocrat, politician, movie star, for all I know, that person has got to have the confidence of the people when he speaks to them and says very plainly, we're all going to have to take some cuts.
But I go back to the question, Congressman Al, should we replace with bankers?
No, I don't think technocrats is the answer. Here's the problem. I believe, just take our country, for example. The Democrats have had a line of reasoning and defense forever, and it hasn't changed. You mentioned defense, cut it. Social Security, don't cut it. The Republicans, likewise, have had certain things that you can utterly predict. The fact is, neither of them are right. And it's as though the problem was a donkey, and the Republicans and the Democrats decided to use the carrot and the stick. And so the Republicans positioned themselves perfectly in front of the animal, and the Democrats got around behind it with the carrot. and then wondered why the animal didn't go anywhere, why the animal didn't behave the way they wanted it to. The fact is that we need some people who are not ideologically committed to a specific way out of this. And I don't know how you put that together, but we've got to have some Republicans who understand that the military and some of their other favorite programs are going to be part of this. And you've got to get the Democrats the Democrats' job with Social Security and Medicare is see that it is cut in the places that will do the least damage to the people it's there to help. Not that it won't hurt, but the least damage. The Republicans' job on defense is to see that we don't do something really stupid, that we make those cuts in as intelligent a way and in the ways that hurt the least. Neither side are in the frame of mind to look at it that way, and it makes it difficult to see how, in fact, we're going to get anything done.
Bob, I mean, you know, we're talking about a country, though, here in America, where we have a retirement age of basically 62. We have a Social Security program that is paid into versus a entitlement program that we see prevalent in Europe. You know, we are also seeing some economies that arguably aren't as, let's say, productive as we would say the big two, France and Germany, or we'll bring the UK into this. At what point, I mean, the greatest example I see in Greece is our host here, Bob, who used to work in Greece for a Greek. He would tell me stories of how they would work and they would get paid for 9 months of work, but they would be paid for 13. They get all kinds of sick time, all kinds of vacation time. You know, even if you work from day one, even if you worked for a day, you automatically got a pension because you were already paid into to the national pension fund. You know, those type of things. As Al said, that's hard to take away from, you know, just Americans dealing with Social Security. How hard is it to take away that from an entitlement-driven society like a European society?
Well, it's hugely hard. I mean, even if it wasn't excessive, quote-unquote, as it is in most countries in Europe, the fact of the matter is it's been there for a long time. People have expected it. They feel it's their right, their birthright, and they're not going to lose it if they can help it. Now, what they're going to have to do in country after country, it looks like over there in Europe, is understand that if they don't fundamentally change the systems, the whole thing is going to collapse and there won't be anything. There won't be a reduction. There'll be a zero.
Al.
Exactly. Exactly. If there was somebody that was capable, I'm missing a word I want, but forget that, was capable of explaining to each of these countries what life is going to be like if they don't do some of these things and do that in a realistic and believable way, I don't think that there's any alternative to simply letting that happen. Once they collapse and life becomes really awful, then you start all over again and slowly build back. That's a tragic way to have to do it. But if you can't convince the people that giving up a little bit here on their vacation and a little bit there on their Medicare and a little bit here and there that will hurt, that the solution is it's going to hurt a whole hell of a lot more because you're going to get dumped in the ditch.
You know, it's going to be a situation where if you refuse to lose a couple of joints on your pinky finger, they're going to cut off your arm because that's what's going to happen.
But this brings up a good question, though, and Alan, I want
to use a true Italian.
Apparently, Bob is using the Don Corleone political method. And to go into the theoretical world, because we know that you love answering those questions, Alan. Theoretically, is there even a message that the Greek government could get out to the populace to get them to swallow this jagged pill?
Well, I think that ultimately what they have to do is say, here are our dire choices. We got this rotten option over here where we swallow bitter medicine now in the hope that over time things can improve. Or we don't swallow that bitter medicine now, and even worse medicine will be visited upon us by forces beyond ourselves. Please support option A over option B. And then you see what happens. The challenge in this Eurozone, though, that we've talked about is you've got these other countries that are tied in. In the old days, Greece would just watch inflation soar out of control and the value of their currency collapse, savings collapse, property values collapse, and the medicine would be spread far and wide to the holders of the unique Greek currency. This time, it's not as complicated, but that doesn't mean that the other European countries have unlimited willingness to back the Greece, or for that matter, Italian paper that many other banks hold.
This has got to be a wake-up call for the White House and for the president, obviously, Bob. You know, what is the message that we could possibly take away that would make the Super Committee, Congress, and the White House stand up and say, hey, kids, we're really not that far away?
Well, I think it would take what Al said earlier. We have got to find, we've got to have people who are prepared to bite the bullet and do what has to be done, and take ways to find cuts that are well spread around and no hurt nobody too much. Revenues have to be increased. The Republicans have got to understand that. I don't like it. I'm a Republican. I don't like to be raising taxes, but I think it's fair to say that our tax system is out of whack pretty badly, and we've done it to ourselves. We find ourselves with a growing senior citizen population, with the next generation beyond behind the baby boomers who are now hitting the 65-year number. The next generation is substantially smaller. We're going to have to recognize there are fewer people paying in than we need in order to pay the benefits we now are providing. We just have to recognize it. We're in the same position, although not nearly as bad as Greek or Italy or some other countries. We're not nearly as bad, but we are still on that road.
Alan.
I remember in the last Congress, former Senator Jed Gregg from New Hampshire, when he was rather an expert on some of the economic trends and forces at play, likened America to the future a future banana republic, a developing country that couldn't manage itself and had its debt too high. Well, now to expand the Judd Gregg notion for what politicians here can say, okay, if you don't buy the banana republic analogy, do you want to be the next Greece? Do you want to be the next Italy? It's been coming, but I think that's about the only way that these issues, or the one of the more significant ways that these issues can play out in U.S. politics.
Al, you had a comment.
I've had an idea going back to Graham Rudman, and I don't know who to talk to. I don't know how to make it happen. But it seems to me that you ought to be able to put together a computer game, which will show you if you cut this, these things happen. If you cut that, these things. If you don't do it, these things will happen. And kind of throw it out and say, you balance the budget. And it is a way, frankly, of getting Americans to have a more realistic view of the situation in which we find ourselves.
Well, they have. I mean, right now, economists use economic model, computer simulations, computer modeling to come up with some of these ideas.
You have to simplify it considerably. No. But this is so that Joe Schmo in Des Moines can sit down at his computer.
Oh, absolutely. Like an app on an iPhone, you could download this model and say, hey, look, if you do this, this is going to be the payout.
Yeah. And if you don't want to increase taxes, then go ahead and do your cuts. If you don't like some of the cuts, then take a look at what your options are in taxes. I don't know that this is going to convince them that any specific thing should be done, but what they need to be convinced is that something needs to be done, and the game might do that.
Alan, you have a comment on that?
It's another one of Al's dumb ideas.
Al spoke beautifully. No. Actually, I think Al gets to a really important point, and that is that most of us don't understand very well how things all fit together in the U.S. system. There's a lot of resentment right now to people who seem to have more. We've talked about that in the past, how I think that's an unhealthy sentiment to feed. It's a very real sentiment. It's a natural sentiment, but it's dangerous to stoke those particular fires. But in terms of getting people to look at that and learn, I'm not sure about their willingness, and I'm not sure about whether they would believe it. They'd say, oh, it's a game. This isn't true. We earn our benefits.
Right.
I think that's a very real possibility. People would not want to believe it. But you could eliminate some misconceptions. Who's the guy that said it ain't what you don't know that hurts, it's what you know that ain't so?
Right.
And I remember going back to Graham Rudman. I'd get mail and saying, I'll tell you, you dumb.
Whatever.
Whatever. How you can balance the budget, you eliminate foreign aid. Well, foreign aid was 0.6% of the budget, a sixth of 1% of the budget. You could have eliminated all of the foreign aid and not made a dent.
Right.
So that would be a reality. You know, they'd learn something about the reality of the situation we're in.
But going around the table, this, again, a wake-up call for the president, but is this maybe a sign to come? Is this maybe a crystal ball for the Obama White House saying, hey, look, we may not be too far. We may only be a year out from going through the same thing. Al?
I would think that the White House should be concerned about that, but then I think the Republicans should be concerned about that. If this thing collapses, there ain't going to be any heroes. I think John Boehner's future rests as much on this as the president's.
Bob, same question to you.
If we don't solve this problem, there will be no heroes and everybody will be to blame, fundamentally up here. The government itself will be to blame, and rightly so. I mean, look at the rating of the Congress now. Was it 9 or 10 or 15%, something like that? I mean, you know, it may well be that the president isn't particularly popular, but it is also true that the Congress is seen as a bigger negative than it has a much lower rating than does the president. I mean, he's in the 30s or 40s, and they're down in 15. The problem is everybody sees the Congress is not doing the job they're supposed to be doing, and they're doing a pretty good job of saying to the public, "You're right."
Yes, yes.
Alan, I go to you the same question.
Well, I don't see it as much as a wake up call, like a morning alarm, but you know that alarm's been going off for a couple of years, and then we hit the pause button, and then it kicks back on again. So it's nothing new here. It's the same stuff. It's one more example of what can go wrong. I did find it interesting that after the news of Berlusconi's loss in this vote in the parliament and his announcement that he would step down, once budget reforms occur, I'm not little unclear what that means. The stock market went up 100 points.
When we come back, we're going to talk about another problem that the White House is having. Apparently, the word on the street is that White House staffers, there's a little bit of tension, a little bit of turmoil going on at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and Bill Daley is turning over some of the operations as chief of staff to his deputy. We're going to dive into that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Blow to a lovely tune.
is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We are going to continue the discussion right now on a more domestic front. Right now, there is some tension, some turmoil. There's a lot of questions being asked about what's going on over at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In a story that was that broke through the Wall Street Journal Monday night, it appears that White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley, longtime political insider here inside Washington politics, is now turning over some of the day-to-day Chief of Staff responsibilities to Pete Rouse, his Deputy Chief of Staff and longtime presidential confidant. That is surprising to a lot of people here in Washington. Reasons, now the White House is obviously downplaying this. Press Secretary Jay Carney told reporters on Air Force One that, quote, a little bit more is being made of this than is in fact happening. Carney went on to say, quote, Bill Daley is Chief of Staff and retains responsibility. However, there are some issues that have popped up recently, namely Chief of Staff Daley sat down in a very open discussion with a political reporter named Roger Simon and did not advise the White House press office, which is a no-no. But this is a little bit more volatile and a little bit of a big deal. There was always a little bit of tension under Rahm Emanuel and Rahm's departure back to Chicago, bringing in Bill Daley, another Chicago longtime Politico boss. Everybody thought that Bill was going to be the savior of the Obama White House. Does this surprise you, Bob?
Well, you know, I'm a little surprised that Bill Daley, it seems either to be a little bit being pushed out or a little bit wanting to get out. I'm not sure which it is or what's happening. And the White House certainly doesn't tell me much. So I don't know what's going on there. But it's always unsettling if the White House is in somewhat confusion or disarray, whatever the correct phrase would be. If that is the case, it isn't good for the country.
Now, Alan, you're familiar with Bill Daley. You've been around politics quite a bit, and he was the Commerce Secretary under Bill Clinton. Daley's always been kind of a straightforward, you always knew where you stand with him, kind of an F-bomb kind of guy. Does it surprise you that maybe the White House, the kind of the kumbaya mentality at the Obama administration, does that maybe counteract some of what Bill Daley is there to do?
You know, I think it's just a case it didn't work out, and I think he's done. I think they're now paving the way for Pete Rouse, a guy who knows his way around town, a lot of knowledge and relationships on the Hill. Smart guy. He operates under the radar. He's taking over day-to-day management. That's what chiefs of staff do. And Daley is apparently moving out to sort of some kind of external affairs role. And then you got Carney, the press secretary, saying, No, we're not transferring duties. We're adding, not subtracting. Oh, come on, that's such nonsense. I think that what you're gonna see here in a few months is that Daley is gonna have a health issue. He's gonna wanna spend more time with his family. Pete Rouse, who will be running things on a daily basis, Will you know, and operating as sort of a de facto chief of staff, will become in fact the chief of staff. That's not a knock on Daley. That's not a knock on the president. Sometimes stuff doesn't work out. But I think his biggest recent mistake was when he did this interview with Politico, not telling the press. He's chief of staff. He can do what he wants. It's smart to tell the press, but he doesn't have to get permission. It's what he said, because he trashed Rahm Emanuel in some ways that seemed odd and unnecessary. He made references, in fact, to how he Daley, was not going to become leaker-in-chief, with the implication that that's what Emanuel did. A lot of people knew that Emanuel had great relationships with the press, leaked stuff all the time, but people don't talk about it, especially their successor, and that was a significant a signal to me.
Yeah, the quote that he had in the report with Politico was, quote, I am not as aggressive leaking and stroking. I am not reflecting on Rom, but I am not angling for something else, you know? Rom is a lot younger, and he knew he was going to be doing something else in 2 years or 4 years or 8 years, and I'm in a different stage. I'm not going to become the leaker in chief.
Right.
Obviously, a stab at Rahm Emanuel, but you know, when we look at chiefs of staff, you know, the thought and the mentality behind the chiefs of staff has always been: you really don't have to like him, but you got to work for him and you got to respect him. He is the chief whipcracker in the White House. Is that accurate, Alan?
I think that's accurate. And your first question was I surprised? And I was thunderstruck. And it seems to me that they just lost the only adult over at the White House.
Well, it does beg the question, Bob, is there adult supervision at 1600 Pennsylvania right now? Who, in fact, can drive the staff the way it needs to be driven without all the touchy-feely kumbaya stuff that we hear coming out of the White House?
Well, Roush is highly regarded, and he's very close to the president personally, and that's a plus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's a good manager or not on the level that he is now going to be required to do. I suspect that he is pretty good, and I feel that, you know, if he in fact is going to take over and have full responsibility, whether he's called the chief of staff or not, if he's going to run it a good tight ship, that'll be a plus for the president.
But Alan, you know, there was the word coming out of several White House staffers is, you know, he didn't have the open door policy that Rahm did. He's very much a closed door manager. He very tightly controlled not only access to the Oval Office, but the information going in and out. Is that too strict a chief of staff, or is that what we expect out of a White House chief of staff?
And all kinds of different models can work. What can't work is when you have leaks from the White House trashing the guy who's at the top, shifting responsibilities around.
But this wasn't a leak. I mean, this was an all-out, just straight from the horse's mouth.
No. What I'm saying is the people saying he had a closed-door policy.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh,
when
okay.
You start getting these pot shots taken at the top guy, it tells you that things are a little bit out of control. That's why I think his days are numbered. It's not a knock on the president. It's not a knock on him. There are plenty of adults over there, including Pete Rouse and guys on the NSC. It's just that Daley didn't work out. He wasn't that close to the president, and it turned out that some of the people who are very close to the president, who are probably the ones saying, well, here were some of his challenges, some of his issues, some of his weaknesses, etc., he had the self-inflicted wound, I think, of the Politico, and that probably was the final nail on the coffin.
But traditionally, we've always thought that the chief of staff should be the eyes and ears of what the internal workings of the White House should be. But we've seen a lot of names like David Plouffe. Apparently, Daley doesn't get along with David Plouffe at all. Apparently, there's a lot of campaign veterans inside the White House that just don't agree with the efficiencies. And let's make no bones about it. Daley was brought in to create certain efficiencies on how things, there was just too much information coming out of the White House. You know, Bob, the efficiencies that came out, and, you know, who's running? Is it more political or is it more operational? Who's got the big chain here?
I haven't got the faintest idea.
Who should have the big chain?
Well, first of all, the president should have who he wants as his chief of staff, because he's got to have confidence in the person who's meeting with him every morning at 8 o'clock or 7:30, whenever they start, and telling him what's going on, what's happened, what's going on, this is what he's going to have to deal with. He's got to have confidence in that person. It doesn't make a difference who it is.
He's got to support him.
That's right. And if it doesn't, if whoever the president wants is the guy, you know, as long as the guy knows what he's doing, you've got the relationship you want. And if he doesn't have it, something's wrong.
But, Congressman Al, you know, you mentioned he's got to support him. Supporting him, you would see that, you know, at least a story like this would never break if there was a huge amount of trust and support coming from the Oval Office towards chief of staff.
I agree.
This obviously is not the case with Daley.
I agree.
But at some point, is this a sign that maybe Obama is putting too much reliance on his political advisors and not so much on his policy advisors?
That is one possibility. Who knows for sure? But if he is not sending the signal to everybody else in the White House that Daley is my spokesman and you go through him, then he is cutting his legs off, and he can't function the way a chief of staff should function.
Now, if in fact the deputy chief of staff does become the full chief of staff, the appointed chief of staff, that's obviously going to be a dynamic change in the way that operations are handled at the White House. With 1 year to go to the elections, is that a smart idea, Bob? Or is the White House downplaying it and saying, hey, look, we're not in chaos?
Well, I mean, if I were to be hard about this, I would probably say something that would be, the president is already in campaign mode. He's been clearly that way for the last couple of months. Daley is not a campaign manager. The other guys who are there, like Roush and Plouffe and the rest of them, those are the people who have run his campaigns before. They're going to be running them again, and he's running a campaign now already. And it may very well be that all we're seeing here is a case of we're going into campaign mode full time all the way. That may be what it
they
is.
They were going into
know.
That when they appointed Bill Daley.
Yeah, that's
the big question here.
Yeah.
Al,
and it didn't work out.
It didn't work. They tried it.
Yeah,
it didn't work. So what do? You say, Daley's out and a new guy's in, and it makes, big news, staff shakeup. This is a way to try to avoid that negative story that things are in disarray, but it doesn't fly. It doesn't cut it. It says, and it isn't to say that he's a bad person, doesn't have any ability. He's going to be sort of Mr. Outside. And this other guy who's been counselor and former deputy chief of staff when Rahm Emanuel was there, who turned down the chief of staff job, is now going to come in and be, in effect, the chief of staff. They won't call it that for now, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if a couple of months from now, Daley leaves, Rouse becomes the chief of staff, not because he's a political guy. The political people are Val Ruggiero and David Plouffe, and we can talk about them because they're pretty annoying, and or Plouffe in particular is saying really inappropriate things on Sunday shows, it seems to me, because we're paying his salary, and all he is pure politics all the time. But I think that there's they don't want the negative vibes of replacing Daley, and maybe this will work. When Ronald Reagan brought in Howard Baker, the then retired senator, to be his chief of staff, he wasn't an operations guy. He had Ken Duberstein with him as his deputy.
Right.
And the two of them worked side by side. They knew each other. They trusted each other. Baker could do hand-holding on the Hill and be more the outside, and Duberstein could be the nuts and bolts guy on the inside. It's not that you can't make a lot of different arrangements work. You don't usually make this kind of a change, though, and then pretend it's just adding here and not subtracting there. This is a very big deal that tells you that Daley's effectively...
So you wouldn't agree with Jay Carney's statement of a little bit more is being made of this than in fact is happening?
That's nonsense, but that's the storyline.
That's the line going to be coming out of the White House.
Yeah. What do they want to say?
Yeah,
is a really, really big deal here, people.
Yeah. What else would they want to say? This is just business as usual, a little maneuver here and there.
But this seems like you talk about Baker and Duberstein. I mean, the relationship they had. One was the Hill walker, the hall, you know, walk around the halls of Congress, the deal maker. The other one was the actual overlord inside the White House. The idea of bringing in Bill Daley was kind of the opposite, where you have somebody like Pete Rouse, who, a longtime Hill insider, a lot of people called him the 101st senator. He was very, very, very popular, very well respected, but Daley was the operator. Again, I go back to the question of at what point does the Obama administration start saying, and this is something we've talked about on the show before, at what point does the Obama administration saying, look, we obviously have a problem here inside as far as getting our policies, our messaging out. Somebody's got to hold the reins and hold the responsibilities. It looked like Bill Daley would be the right one, but it seems like the politics are driving what's going on at the White House more so than the actual policy and messaging. Am I wrong in that assessment?
I don't know that it's the politics. It's just the skill sets, the expectations, and the way things played out. It didn't work out.
Would it have been better, Bob, for the White House just to say, hey, Bill, look, this relationship isn't working out. Why don't you go back and spend time with your family, and we'll issue a statement on that, instead of this little almost three-card Monty that they're playing at staff?
I don't think that flies, given how short a time he's been there. I think that's kind of a hoo-ha, too. So the fact that it happened this quickly after he'd been appointed doesn't really give them a lot of scenarios that they can fly credibly, I don't think.
Yeah. He's been there, what, less than a year?
Oh, yeah. And I think that Allen's saying that it just didn't work out. There's got to be a way to sweeten that a little bit, but that's probably what they should say.
But Daley is currently at the G20 with the president in Europe. He is scheduled to go to APEC in Hawaii at the end of the month. Is obviously the president still holds him in some regard, and he's still got the ear of the president, but it seems like there's a lot of conflict going on.
I don't know that he has the ear of the president.
Would you bring him to APEC if he didn't?
The question is the president listening to his people, and was he listening to Bill Daley? Or is he listening to so many people that he gets confused? I don't know.
Alan?
You know, there's no evidence that the president has turned 180 degrees on Daley. He presumably likes the guy. He presumably sees value in the guy. He presumably also, though, agrees that a change of responsibilities is in order, because what he wants, what he needs inside the White House as a chief of staff and what he was getting from Daley are two different things. So rather than just say, you're out, you're in, they're going to try a different model. I don't think it'll work. And I won't, you know, I say the Daley will move on. Maybe Daley will get an ambassadorship. Maybe he'll get a cabinet post of some sort. It's, you know, he's an accomplished guy. He's not working out as chief of staff. And we can acknowledge that. That's what happened today. That's what we're reading.
But this does beg also a much larger question is, you know, we've talked about the problem about getting messaging out of the White House. The White House has had a problem with getting policy through Congress, whether it was a Pelosi-led House or it was a Boehner-led House. I guess the bigger question is the president listening to too many different people? Is he getting almost sensory overload as president of the United States?
You stated that so nicely. I said confusion. You said sensory overload.
Yes.
I like that.
Right. Well, then we're all about civility here,
yeah,
Al.
That's right.
Al, I'll go to you. I mean, what do you think?
Wasn't Bill Daley one of the key people in the Al Gore campaign?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
He ran Al Gore's campaign pretty much at the end.
Okay. When the whole Florida thing blew up and the Republicans brought in one of the brightest men and best politicians in this town to handle it,
Jim Baker.
But Daley went home to Chicago. Remember that?
Yes.
And they left a third-ranking person there to handle it. And I have been told by people who were very, very high at one time in the Gore campaign, and who were one of the ones that left, said Al Gore didn't listen. Now, knowing Al Gore, that's very easy to believe. He is enormously self-confident. Let's just put it civilly.
That's very simple.
And I'm wondering if Daley were to say, oh my God, here it is all over again, and I don't want to play that game.
Alan?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, we never shy from speculation here.
No, we don't. I mean, that's part of that makes great radio.
And I
we tell all in facts, that wouldn't be fun.
And I certainly don't shy away from speculating. I don't know here how that well how the president functions. He's a focused guy. He's a smart guy. He's got some smart people around him. He's got a lot of political types. You sense increasingly a tension between the political and the policy folks. And I say political meaning presidential politics. There's also this need to deal with the Hill. The president, that is not his strength. He wasn't there that long. And he's got some people around him who understand that. I think Rahm Emanuel understood the House very, very well. The Senate, not as well. Daley, he's not a creature of the Congress. I think this is an area where they need help. But ultimately, it comes down to the president and him feeling comfortable with people around him in the roles that they have. Daley didn't work out.
Bob, have you seen this type? I mean, you've been around White House cabinets, around White House staff for a good chunk of your time here in Washington. Do you think that maybe the president has to now sit down and say, look, I've got a lot on the plate. I've got a re-election coming out here. This is my guy. He's got to actually drop the hammer right now and show leadership.
I think Alan is right. I think it just didn't work out. And he's trying to find another way to make it work out. That's what I think.
Wow. I think the answer to your question is yes.
Wow. Interesting. It's a happy hour here at Shelley's Back Room right now. We're going to take a couple of minutes. We're going to order our martinis, order our wine, our beer, and our Jack Daniels, get another cigar to light up. And when we come back, we're going to talk about we'll talk about Herman Cain. That's just too much fun.
He's on TV
right now. Cain is about to respond to his accuser. Breaking news is four women say that he has sexually harassed them. Apparently, there's another three or four in the wings. But we'll talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And we're live here back at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It's happy hour and the final hour of, actually the final 49 minutes of Backroom Politics here in Washington, D.C. As we start talking about Herman Cain and the issues that the GOP frontrunner is having, lo and behold, breaking news out of Arizona. Herman Cain is right now responding to the accusations of sexual harassment in a prepared statement being given in Scottsdale. We will update you as we get more details on his speech and his statement. But we talked about it last week, and we kind of played it off, you know, this is amateur hour, and this is an amateur move. Yet the surprising thing about this is Herman Cain's numbers haven't dropped. If anybody's fallen more, it's been Rick Perry, but Herman Cain hasn't seen a dramatic decrease in support and popularity. His polling numbers seem to be just as high as they were before the news broke.
But has there been a poll since the woman yesterday?
Nope. No, there has not.
So we don't know.
No.
We don't know what he's saying now.
And
so
we need to remember that the allegations were made by people who were unidentified and did not want to reveal who they were nor speak. So it was
The allegations of the first two were done as a result of them being a signatory to a non-disclosure agreement. Let's be clear about that.
That's right.
There has been others who have come out, namely the lady last night with always present in sexual scandals, Gloria Allred, which we'll talk about that in a second. But the reality is,
I'd like to rephrase that. I think he could be sued for that remark.
All right, let me rephrase. Yeah. She's an attorney that is always present around people that have always been around these type of issues
and representing
them. Yeah. But the reality is, this lady, Belalik, who was apparently a staffer at the National Restaurant Association, made some pretty scathing comments about the pizza owner.
Scathing. They were rather precise and bordered on pornographic. But
Cain right now just said, quote, "I have never done anything inappropriate." I got an NDA out of the National Restaurant Association and a settlement for a year's salary for two individuals that would say differently. Alan, you've been around this town a long time. This is obviously something that continues to explode.
It's just a matter of time before this all collapses around him. He could hang on to this thread over the last week of the argument that the charges were anonymous. But the charges, as we know, were based on significant financial settlements made to two different women a dozen years ago. And then those women chose not to come forward because they didn't want to be in the public spotlight and be embarrassed and embarrass their families. All of that made sense. It fed the storyline that the charges were anonymous. But they weren't out of the blue. It wasn't as though they didn't have a history. They have a very deep written history that led to significant financial settlements. What was different yesterday is here was a woman who came forward and said, "This is what he did to me." The lawyer for one of the others said, "Those are consistent with what he did to her." I think Cain has run out the string of denial because now we got four different accusers with, as we say, presumably a couple more out there. And now he's taken the trash the accuser line. You remember last week he said that one of these people had supposedly had performance problems on the job,
right,
which was a trashing. Now what he's saying about the woman who spoke out yesterday is, don't know her, never seen her, never did anything with her. Come on. He is desperately hanging on, and people want to blame the media and believe in him. It's not lasting. It's just a matter of time before he's done.
But, Bob, I mean, you look, and by the way, for those listening, Herman Cain just came out, and his quote is, "I absolutely reject the charges," unquote. And he goes on to say, quote, "It absolutely did not happen," which, You know, it's funny. We saw this in 1996 with a governor out of Arkansas named Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, the rumors flying around about Governor Clinton in 96, I mean, he pretty much was running a kegger out of the governor's mansion at any given point. But he managed to survive and become a very popular president, one who many would love to see come back in, and he would get elected no problem. How does a Bill Clinton survive, but yet Herman Cain pulls an amateur move like this, saying that it absolutely did not happen?
Because Bill Clinton wasn't an amateur.
Good point. A very valid point. Well, you kind of put the nail on that one, didn't you, Al?
Yeah.
Thank you. But seriously, I mean, you know, what is the difference between a Herman Cain and a Bill Clinton? Similar charges were levied, and, you know, some of them were not were inappropriate moves. Some of them were consensual. How does a Bill Clinton survive this, Bob? And Herman Cain have to do with the problems he's dealing with now?
Well, I think Al said in a very short statement a lot of what the difference is. I mean, Mr. Cain is newer at the national political scene. And I think he probably doesn't realize how, absolutely saying, you know, nothing ever happened. I don't even know the woman who was on television yesterday. I mean, those are extremely. I mean, he is either right, and they're all wrong, or he is just blowing smoke.
Well, and he's saying on C-SPAN right now, the Democratic machine in America has brought forth a troubled woman.
He's obviously taking pot shots at his accusers.
Yeah.
Yep.
That to me seems like a bad idea. Am I wrong in that, Al?
Well, I think you're wrong, and I think it's wrong because I don't think the Democrats are dumb enough to spend their time and effort and energy going after him when they've got much more impressive candidates that they should be more, you know, more wary of than Herman Cain. If they were going to try and slice somebody up, it would be Rick Perry, or it would be Romney or somebody like that. I would think they.
This is absolutely astonishing to me as we see this. I agree with Al. I mean, the Democratic Party obviously has got better things to do with its time than to bring forward an entire political machine against Herman Cain. I mean, people inside the Beltway know Herman Cain just did not have the sustainability to be a quote-unquote front-runner to get the nomination for President of the United States out of the GOP. I would venture to say that the DNC is probably not worried about a Herman Cain. But for him to make the statement that it was the Democrats who pulled this off and they're just taking a shot at me, is this going to continue to blow up in his face, Bob?
Well, I'll wait. What we really need is to see is another woman or two come forward and say, this is what happened. I was there. I was part of it. He put his hand, you know, on my knee or whatever. And I think we get a couple more women speaking up, and I gather we may see that shortly. That'll be the last nails in the coffin, I think.
That this does that could be to Herman Cain's benefit is that if the Tea Party stays with him, and bringing in the Democrats and blaming them, I think, helps him in that regard, because they tend to believe the Democratic Party is the devil incarnate anyway. So that may be able to glue them a little tighter to their support for him for a little bit longer.
Alan.
Yeah, this blaming the Democratic machine is a new one. It's another, it seems to me, sort of a desperate grasping exercise. There's no evidence of any of that. I think something that did resonate a little bit in recent days was the left-leaning media going after him, keeping this alive, triggering it. And how come, coming back to your earlier question, they're going after Cain when back when stuff was surfacing about Clinton, they were relatively disbelieving, relatively quiet. Is it a double standard? Well, that was then, this is now. I don't think that the double standard, which one could see over this intervening period of 15, 20, 18 years, but today the press is all over it. It doesn't matter who. And I don't think that if a bill, it'd be interesting if a Bill Clinton were to emerge today with his history of serial affairs that were consensual and also behavior that was non-consensual, where he was the aggressor, more in the line of what Cain is being accused of. I think it would be a much, much bigger deal now, Democrat or Republican.
I agree with that, and let's remember the press was all over the governor of New York, who had to resign on the same kinds of issues.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the affair that Governor Elliot Spitzer had here at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. But you know, when Herman Cain says stuff and he just came out and said, quote, "I will take a lie detector test," that sounds a lot like the voice of a guilty man. I mean, being a former cop, I gotta tell you something. He's acting very much on the defensive almost.
Well, he's really rolling the dice on that.
Yes.
Because, you know, somebody is gonna say, okay, you know, we'll be available next Tuesday at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you come over here. We'll run the polygraph on you. And you know, I'm sure that's possible to beat a polygraph. I'm sure it isn't in some people, but that's an awfully big risk to take unless you truly believe what he is saying, that I never did anything to any of these women.
But Alan, go ahead.
Employers don't shell out a year's salary to people,
let alone when associations here in Washington.
When nothing happened, it's really, really rare, and not twice in a period of a year or so with the same executive. It doesn't happen, and then more come out. I mean, these behaviors tend to be serial. He had one chance, it seems to me. Cain did early on, when he was warned that this was going to come out, to say, let's let it all out there. Let me acknowledge some mistakes. Let me say I'm a sort of an old-fashioned guy, and I did some inappropriate things that I deeply, deeply regret, and I want to apologize to the women involved and hope that we can put this behind us. He chose instead to the old notion, the best defense is a good offense. Go on the offensive. Deny everything and trash your accusers. Sorry, folks, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work with the Tea Party over time. It's not going to work with the media. It's not going to work with the public at large.
And in terms of the media putting focus on it, every time he denied it, he gave the media an additional story to work with.
He had a constantly shifting story.
Well, the constantly shifting story was it did not happen, and I simply will not address it. Then you would address it, and then I didn't know about it.
A little bit happened,
and then I didn't know about the settlement, but I did know about the settlement. And apparently, it's not just at the National Restaurant Association. Apparently, some of these accusers are going back to his days at Pillsbury, which shows, again, your point of, hey, this guy's got a history of this, perhaps.
And that's almost always the case. And women know when it's the case. Women see behaviors. They protect each other. This is how it works. This is what was not present in the Clarence Thomas case.
Right.
But it's what is all over the circumstances in this particular case. Sometime when Herman Cain is long gone and out of our memory, unless he's on a speaking tour and writing books, if anybody buys them or pays for them, this will be a one of those case studies about how not to deal with sexual charges.
Well, Bob, you know, we look at this, and then, you know, we've also heard stories of the fact that this is obviously something he's admitted to being a problem back when he ran for Senate in Michigan as a Republican candidate back in 2003. He told his staffers, hey, look, this might come up and bite us, come up with a plan. You would think that would have been enough to say, okay, we have to have a policy for this. Why does a Herman Cain not do at least an opposition vetting it obviously talked about in a Senate campaign, but on a national presidential campaign, that's got to be even more decisive.
Well, it to me, what that indicates is that he just isn't ready for prime time, so to speak. He doesn't he hasn't protected himself as he should have. If there is a problem, now, you know, according to him, there is no problem, so there's no reason. Now, but there is evidence to indicate that there is a problem. And if that is true, you would have thought that a wise man would have basically got a defense structure set in place. And he clearly did not have that. Now, again, you can argue from that is that he is innocent because, you know, he didn't feel the need to be anything like that. But, my God, I mean, it's coming.
Is that political naivety?
Yes, it is. When you're running for president, you have to, even if you just sit down in the dark room all by yourself, but you've got to think about everything that could ever be brought up against you and decide what I'm going to do if it comes up. And then sit down with the best people you've got around you and say, this is a potential problem, and this is what I think we should do, but you tell me what's the best way to handle it. Clearly, he has not done any thinking like that. And whether he's innocent or guilty, I mean, the fact that he's failed to do that indicates how unready he was for what he's trying to achieve.
I gotta tell you something. I've been involved in many campaigns, and let's be honest. I mean, we're all human. We all have made mistakes in our time. But anytime you've made a mistake, you've always, at least in any of the campaigns I've been involved with, always come up with a defense mechanism, like you say. It seems to me here that on something this national, this campaign is pretty much a fly by your pants, and either he's not listening to his people, or he's actually sitting there thinking, well, this is not a big deal. Alan.
Well, there's just two things I'm thinking about. One, you know, we refer to him as a front runner because he and Romney have the most votes right now. But remember, if he's at 21%, that means that 79% of Republicans are going in a different direction. So let's just keep it in context. Same could be true for Romney, but
right.
But it's not like he's got this massive support. He's got this core of support that maybe, you know, some of the Tea Party's angry folks, sexual harassers, I have no idea where that comes from. But I think one of the most telling things that we've seen over the last 8 days when this stuff first emerged is how the other Republicans are basically leaving it alone, saying these are important questions, we need answers. Now, why would they leave it alone? It seems to me they're leaving it alone because they're watching this guy self-destruct. Last week, I think it was Bob who talked about if somebody's committing political suicide, don't
give
get
him
in the
rope.
Mix of it.
Give
just stand
rope.
Off and watch. And I think that's what's happening here. And it's it's not that Kane's a horrible person, a bad guy. I think he's out of his element.
He's over his head.
He and his team are totally over their heads and beyond their skill levels. Unfortunately, now they're doing some harm to other people. And women are beginning to step up. I noticed that Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said today, gee, if these charges are true, he should step aside.
Absolutely.
But it shouldn't just be women who say that. It should be the men who love women, who have women who are married to, our sisters, brothers of, fathers of. It's just really wrong what's
happening,
and there's some anger that's missing here that I think is going to start welling up as he continues to trash the credibility and history of some of these women.
Well, Bob, this brings up a very valid point. At which point does the RNC and Reince Priebus start taking them aside, saying, "Hey, look, the circus is over. At some point, you know you cannot survive this. Is that day coming?"
No doubt, assuming that the accusations stand and there continues to be more evidence and further women come forward, obviously the leadership of the party is going to try to get him out of the race as soon as they can. Whether it's the national chairman, whether it's some close political allies of his, which is more likely, people are going to say to him, you know, get out while you still can before you're just ripped to pieces. Because if, you know, these things are, it's like a drip, 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 drip. It just, if the women do come forward and do speak up, in addition to the one who already has, it's bound to be, no matter what the gentleman says, it's bound to be almost overwhelming. And that's, you know, and it's unfortunate in one sense because the guy really, you know, brought something interesting to the table.
Yeah, he did.
He brought something interesting to the table. He had enough guts to put a program out. It may not have been the best tax idea in the world, but it caught people's attention. He speaks well. He's articulate. He's an attractive guy. I mean, he had a lot going for him.
But, Congressman Al, at some point, the Democrats have to look at this. Obviously, the Democrats have taken their step back from this. They're just going to let him continue to self-destruct. But it's almost a situation where you see the polling numbers where, you know, insert GOP candidate here versus president, the GOP wins, yet we can't find a GOP candidate that's going to sustain any sort of maneuvering. Is Mitt Romney's approach low, slow, and under the radar? That seems to be the working methodology right now.
It's sure working. It's working for him. It's working for him very well. And this is drawing attention away from whatever might be legitimate attacks on Romney's record or any of them, Perry's, anybody else's. While everybody's focused on him, there's no room for attacks really on the other candidates.
Well, there's no room either for attacks or for positive statements.
That's
right. I mean, the whole thing is all the air is sucked out of the campaign right now, and it will be for until this is resolved, until the public makes up its mind.
Exactly. At this time, Romney can't give a policy speech and have everybody pay any attention to it because they're all listening to this, nor can Barry or any of the others, I don't think.
Well, you know, it also strikes me, I mean, one of his opening quotes was that I chose to address these allegations. Bob, do you buy that?
Well, when we began, he certainly didn't do that. He just ducked. Now he's addressing it in a way. He is saying, in effect, it didn't happen. I don't care how many people come forward. They're all wrong. I don't even know some of them. But it didn't happen. It did not happen. It did not happen. It did not happen. That's what he's saying. So he's got himself in a situation where it's his word at the moment against at least one woman who has come forward. Others may or may not, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is it's going to be an interesting couple of days because he's really challenging the women right now. He is basically saying anybody who says I've done any of this is lying.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
Right.
And you're going to have to figure out, do you believe Mr. Kane, or do you believe a bunch of women who maybe most of them don't know each other, never met each other, except maybe for the two who worked at the restaurant association, but other women coming forward and saying, this is what happened with me, with him.
Round the horn before we take a break real quick. Question is, does Herman Cain survive the next 30 days? Congressman Al.
No.
Bob.
I don't think so.
Alan.
Nope.
I agree. I don't think he survives 30 days. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about a little tete-a-tete that happened over at the G20 summit between President Obama and French President Nicolas Sarkozy. French President called the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, a liar in front of President Obama. And apparently the White House took offense to that. We'll talk about that and a couple of other items when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Yeah!
Backroom Politics, live from Kelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. For those of you who are following Inside the Beltway Politics, Alan Moore, you have breaking news coming over the wire right now.
Yeah, State Senator Ulysses Curry in Prince George's County was acquitted today of charges that...
influence peddling, corruption.
Influence peddling. So it turns out that you can influence peddle as much as you want, but if you can get some other people to say you're an amiable dunce and didn't really understand what you were doing, that's okay.
It's okay.
Plausible deniability continues to reign supreme inside the Beltway. For those of you who listen inside the Beltway, obviously that's big news coming out of Annapolis right now. But we'll talk about that later. You know, we're going to breeze over. We're going to push off the Sarkozy-Obama till next week. But he's been with us since the beginning of the show. We are fortunate to have probably one of the most familiar voices in politics. If you've ever watched C-SPAN, you know this voice. He is Paul Hayes. He is the former speaking clerk, or the former reading clerk. You always spoke it to me, but you were the former reading clerk in the House of Representatives and a voice familiar to anybody who's watched C-SPAN. Paul, thanks for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed this.
I have had a great time being here. But I want to tell you one thing. I always told people who said, I recognize your voice. The thing you have to remember when you hear my voice or heard my voice back when before I retired was I'm always speaking someone else's words. If you ever hear me speaking my own words, it can only mean I'm in very deep trouble.
Well, I cannot tell you the number of times that I personally have watched C-SPAN, even, you know, I'm not trying to date you or anything, but even as a little kid, you know, listening to your familiar voice read, and now a bill by Mr. Swift and others, that to me, you were the voice of the House, and for many of us growing up and who followed politics early on in our careers. First of all, how long were you the reading clerk? You were there for quite a while.
I worked there for 41 years, but I was the reading clerk for 21 years.
Wow. And you served under five speakers?
Well, I was first hired by Ralph Roberts, and who was the speaker? Was that Tip?
I think it was Carl Albert.
Well, Carl Albert. Who was before? John McCormick.
John McCormick.
It's John McCormick, and then Carl Albert. And then Tip O'Neill. Yeah.
And then gentleman from Washington.
You left Foley.
Jim Wright.
And then Tom Foley. And then Newt Gingrich. And then
Hatter, and then on and on.
And then Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. You've seen a lot of speakers.
Well, you know, I've seen them, and I've sat very close to them, but I'm not really on speaking terms.
A lot of speakers have seen the back of his head.
Yeah, all I recognize every little scar on my head.
Paul, I mean, you've obviously been around you've been around Washington politics for 40 years as the reading clerk. You saw the operation of the House in its most intimate way. How have you seen politics change? I mean, has it become more venomous from then the time you first started?
Venomous is a strong word, but it probably is fairly accurate. Politics has become such a business, almost to the point of being a science, which politics never was supposed to be, but despite calling it political science, it's an art. But it has become, the big change that I've seen is that it has become almost an act of treason to be a friend with a member of the opposition.
Really?
And that's unfortunate. I'm old enough to remember when I was in high school and you could get away with drinking at something below 21. I mean, I think it was legal to drink in Washington at 18, and we got away with it before that. But I remember when I was in high school and we used to come up to the Hill and do volunteer work for congressmen. And a lot of that volunteer work involved running robo-type machines so that they could send out personalized letters, or the auto pen to sign the personalized letters.
You right.
know, this is the great technology of the 1960s. And now everything's done by computers, and it's all done by email, and it's all done very scientifically, and you target your audience, and it's everything you do has to be done because it's a blood sport, and you have to constantly raise money in order to pay for all of this expensive technology that we use in politics. And I think it comes down to Bob Michael's famous explanation of how things became so uncivil in the House. He dates it to the advent of the electronic voting card.
Really?
Because, and I had a role to play in this, sort of. In the old days, prior to 1971 or two, or whatever it was that they started this, voting by card, all the roll calls and all the votes in the House were done by roll call, which meant that the reading clerk stood there in the well of the House and read the names of all 435 members, and then read the names of all of those who hadn't answered the first time around. So there were two calls of the roll before then anyone who still hadn't answered could come down to the well and be individually recognized and cast his vote. And the whole process took anywhere from 35 to 45 minutes, depending on how raucous it was. And if you missed your name the first time it was called, you had to sit there for another 20 minutes or so before it was called again. You couldn't go anywhere. Today, you run into the side door, you ask the doorkeeper, "What's this vote on?" You stick your card in the slot and punch a button, and you're back out in 4 seconds.
Is it a matter of the members just don't affiliate
and
know each other?
They don't get to. The point of that whole story was they got to know each other because they sat around waiting for their names to be called. You know, if you got there and they were calling the H's, you had a long wait till they got to the F's. Essence, I mean. And if you came in and they were calling the T's, you really had a long wait before they got around to the end of the alphabet.
What's the most memorable bill you read in your career that you can think of?
The only thing I ever rehearsed was the one that started resolved that William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States, is impeached.
Wow.
For high crimes and misdemeanors.
Wow. And the funny thing about it is I remember watching that back in the, and I remember you reading that, and that always resonated with me. I mean, it's something that we never would have thought we would have heard in our time, and yet there you were as a reading clerk reading those words.
But as I said, they were somebody else's words. They, you know, I might have had a strong feeling about it, but when I was up there on that podium, I was apolitical.
Right, right. When you see the politics now versus when you were in the well, are you optimistic that we can get back to the time when there was stability, when we would see the members knowing each other, going out? It wasn't unusual for them to, you know, say, you know, your bill be damned, and then go have a drink down at the Monaco. Can we get back to that? Do you think it's possible?
I doubt it. I think the cat's out of the bag. Every election cycle is another war, and you just can't get that back. I think it's lost forever.
Obviously, you know, you saw the dynamics of going in the House. Is it something, I mean, obviously it's going to stay with you forever, but is it something now that you get recognized when you speak? People now look at you and go, "I know that voice, I remember you."
I hope someday people will stop saying that, because I really would like to market my voice, and as the voice of the House, there's a very limited market there. You know?
That's right. Particularly in your own home household.
Yeah, right.
I was going to say, you don't read out house bills in the house anymore, I hope.
Well, I don't know. Should I read the receipt from Costco? I can do
it. It would probably be a
actually,
little bit.
Actually, in the last couple of in the last year, I have done two documentaries. One's a 30-minute documentary that's really more of a Jeremiad about the bane of modern architecture in government buildings. And the other one is an hour-long documentary that's going to be released, I think, next week on the occasion of the bicentennial of the Grand Lodge of Free and Accepted Masons of the District of Columbia.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Excellent. Now, for full disclosure, Paul, you and I are members of the same fraternity.
We are.
We are both Brother Masons. But when you look back and you see all the things that you've read, when you look back, is there one particular legacy that you would like to have as far as your years in Congress go? Is it your voice, or is it that you had something to do with the fact that you were part of the government
well,
and you helped?
I look on the House and I don't want everybody to get all weepy about it, but I look at the House of Representatives and the Capitol building of that dome as sort of the temple of democracy. And I just was... I never started off with the goal of working there. It's just the job opened up in 1966, and I was fortunate enough to get hired for it. They made me promise that if they did hire me, that I would stay for 2 years. And I had to ask them if they would let me sleep on that overnight. I'm 20 years old, and I didn't know what I wanted to do 2 years from then. And 41 years later, I finally got around to retiring. My legacy, I don't think it's... Once you walk out the door, as Al will tell you, as Bob will tell you, once you walk out that door, you're nobody.
Well, not even to your wife.
Not even to your wife.
Well, I can tell you right now, your voice is a lot more familiar to me than Al's ever was. So,
and I might add that it may be easier for staff to realize that truth than some members who still wander around having their phones answered, Congressman so-and-so's office, and
yeah,
they
right.
haven't been in office for 20 years.
Do you, do
even
you still,
if they're answering their own phones.
Now, do you still keep in touch with any of the former speakers that you were vocal for?
Oh, I was never on, I was never a bosom buddy of any of the speakers. I knew a lot of staffers, and I knew a lot of the members who weren't so busy that they didn't have time to talk to the staff, which meant I knew a lot of backbenchers.
Right, right.
And
backbenchers move up.
They move up. I mean, today there are probably a couple of dozen senators who, if they saw me on the street, would call me by my first name. But, you know, they were in the House, they moved to the Senate, and they...
ended up becoming elected officials.
Is that marketable? No.
but it's nice.
It's nice. I ran into a former senator in Staples the other day, and we had a nice long talk.
Well, ironically, we run into Al here at Shelley's quite a bit, and we have a nice long talk
that's
every
right.
Tuesday, 4 to 6.
When we recognize him.
When we recognize him, exactly. Paul, I can't tell you how much of a treat it is to have you here. Thank you for coming in, brother.
Well, thank you for the martini.
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. That's what we do in happy hour.
And the cigar, please. Thank you very much.
That's what backroom politics is all about. But we are coming to my favorite part of the show. This is the final few minutes of the show where we come up and we talk about conjecture, speculation, rumor, and buzz around the Beltway. This is my favorite part. Tell me a story. I'm going to start off this week with Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
Well, it's not a story. It's a statement that I wish that I wasn't going to make, and I'll make it basically because I hope I'm wrong. I'm getting to the, you know, I have been one of those folks who have pretty much thought that the
the super committee would be successful. I'm getting to the point now where I'm looking at it and I'm saying to myself, I'm really concerned about it. I'm not sure they will. I'm beginning to think that they may not have enough time to get it done. I don't know enough about the what could be done, but assuming that they work right up till the very end, the 23rd, let's say, to get a deal and cut a deal, I presume they would find a way, Congress would find a way to extend the time that they have to report until after Thanksgiving so that the congressional budget people can spend their Thanksgiving day instead of having turkey working on parsing out what they've done as far as how much money they've made, they've saved. But I'm getting less and less confident that it's going to happen just listening to the members of the committee talk.
Yeah, yeah. Alan, tell me a story.
I'm going to go outside of Washington to a story that's now national, and it is the number one story in the state of Pennsylvania, and that is the scandalous behavior of a former football coach at Penn State.
Oh, yeah.
Who abused a number of small children using the vehicle of a charity that he had started that apparently did good work. It's toppled the athletic director, a senior vice president of operations at this $4 billion, 96,000 student university, a huge operation. It looks like it's the end of 84-year-old Joe Paterno's football history, and I predict that it will also be the end of the president of the university's tenure, a guy who served 16 years. I think he's done, and I think that given the behavior, the lack of action that all of these men took when confronted with really powerful evidence and not reporting it to police means they need to step down.
Well, I want to piggyback on that. My mom went to Penn State. Unfortunately, none of the five colleges I went to were ever Division 1A. So Penn State's always been my college football team of choice. And I've always grown up seeing Joe Paterno. Joe Paterno's first year was when my mom was in college. And, you know, I see the program, the clean program that he's run. He has always been known as a squeaky clean, running a clean program, and have something in his twilight in his career like this come up and just blacken it is just absolutely troubling to me, like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
I hope to God that, you know, some of the allegations that Joe Paterno knew are untrue. I have a deep faith that Joe Pa probably, if he had known the depth of the scandal, would have done something about it. But I guess those are going to be issues that we're going to be seeing. I do believe, judging from the reports today on ESPN and the New York Times, I don't think Joe Paterno's going to finish the season. And that's unfortunate. That is absolutely unfortunate. Al, got a story? Tell me a story.
I hope that this is true. With the Tea Party out there doing its thing, and the what's the other group?
Occupy Wall Street.
I am hoping that they crystallize enough that every incumbent is going to be in serious danger, and that at last incumbents as well as challengers are going to realize that the public is hungry for people who say, I'll go back there and I'll make things work. And I'll make them work by working with the other party. Be very specific about that. I will work with the other party. I think those people can get elected. And once elected, they've got a commitment to it. And we may, in that way, be able to change the customs in the House.
Right.
I see nothing else that will drive them there except people that are really angry at the incumbents, the right of the left, but both will share the fact that Congress isn't doing the job, and I think that message has to be delivered. I think smart candidates, particularly the non-incumbents, should be making that a major part of their campaign, that I will go back there and I will work with the other party
has some risks for the base of either party, but I think that it could work, and it could bring a new day into the House of Representatives and the Senate, perhaps.
Yeah, good observation.
From your mouth to God's ear.
Exactly. My story is not so much a story about inside the Beltway. It's more of a tribute. Last night, anybody who knows me knows I'm a huge fan of boxing. I used to coach police athletic league boxing. I've been following boxing for a long time. The boxing world lost a true champion last night in Smoking Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier lost his battle with liver cancer last night. Everybody remembers the Thrilla in Manila and the fight of the century. The Ali Frazier fights are still going to go down as probably some of the best heavyweight fights that we have ever seen and may ever see again. He was a stand-up guy, somebody who gave back to his community, somebody who stood by and trying to bring some of the less fortunate urban youths in his community, showing them that there was a way out, there was a future, even if it was by boxing or just by being the best you could be. Joe Frazier was one of the good ones, and he was a champion among champions. And the sporting community, the boxing community, and in particular American society, he's going to be missed. And I hope that he will be thought of well long after we're all gone. Rest in peace, Smoking Joe Frazier. We're going to miss you. Take a knee, champ. You earned it. Next 2 weeks are going to be best ofs, as we all have prior commitments. I will be in the United Kingdom. We're all going to be around. And then the following week is the week of Thanksgiving.
Would you say hello to the Queen when you're...
I will personally say... Well, you know, because you know how close I am to the crown. I will be over in the palace.
Crown Royal.
Crown Jewels, whatever. So the next 2 weeks are going to be best ofs. We're going to have some good best ofs to listen to. We will be back live November 30th here at Shelley's Back Room. By that time, hopefully, the Super Committee will have done something. Bob, you're not thinking so optimistically anymore. But for Fox House, Honorable Bob Hines, Alan Moore, and Paul Hayes, thank you very much for joining us, brother. I'm your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell. We'll be back on the 30th of November. Have a great week. We'll see you then. Take care, everybody.